Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents There Was Night and There Was Morning, a memoir of trauma and redemption by Sarah Scherbel, narrated by Sarah Scherbel. God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. Genesis chapter 1, verse 31. Part 1. Honor your father and your mother. Chapter 1. The Sabbath Queen. When I was young, I loved being a rabbi's daughter. I loved the prayer book's silken pages, the slightly raised ink of the letters. I loved baking challah with my mother on Friday mornings, leaving enough time for the dough to rise and the bread to bake before sundown. I loved my book of Bible stories, with the pictures, and the pictures in my head, which were more vivid and majestic than anything in a book could ever be. The Red Sea splitting, Moses descending the mountain with two stone tablets, God in his throne, listening to our prayers. I loved the synagogue's red velvet seats, the men's cream-colored wool prayer shawls, the cantor's voice of supplication. I loved my mother's Shabbat candlesticks, with their melted, dried wax stuck in the silver handiwork, the weekly rush and quiet, the dishes and silverware, the guests and the chocolates they brought, which we ate after the prayer over the wine, after the prayer over the bread, after the meal, after the singing, after dessert, but before the grace after meals. I loved the silver goblets filled with wine that everyone must sip from, the apples dipped in honey at the beginning of the new year, the fried potato pancakes during Hanukkah when it was cold outside and night came early, the Passover Seder when I got to stay up until midnight, my eyes closing as I sat on my father's lap, exhausted from the hour and from the sweet, dark wine my father permitted me to drink. When I was young, my teacher at Sunday school told us that God is everywhere, and I believed that was true. But that was before I discovered that God can disappear, that God can turn his face, go into quiet hiding, and that even though he is everywhere, you may have to work the rest of your life to find a trace. On Friday mornings, I helped my mother bake challah for Shabbat, the Jewish Sabbath, which began Friday night at sundown and continued until Saturday after dark. I stood next to her on a stool, wearing my red flowered apron, and watched her knuckles sink laboriously into the elastic dough, its fleshiness turned over and over beneath her delicate fingers, yielding a smell that was alive with yeast and comforting with home. I knew that challah dough could become sticky with kneading and that it required frequent dustings of flour to keep it supple. My mother would say, "Sarah, I need more flour now." And she would lift up the doughy sphere so that I could sprinkle the flour, which seemed to me like a special kind of angel's dust, onto the counter space beneath. I smoothed it delicately over the formica surface, the yellow moon suspended in my mother's hands. When Friday night arrived, my father went to synagogue, which we called in Yiddish shul, though nobody in my family spoke Yiddish, not even my mother's father or my father's mother, both of whom seemed more American to me than my own parents. "Give Abba a kiss goodbye," my mother said, using the Hebrew word for father, one of only a handful of Hebrew words in her vocabulary outside of the prayer service, which though she knew well, she didn't understand. "When Abba comes back, it will already be Shabbat." My father left for shul before the Sabbath began so that he could drive there. Once Shabbat started, no use of electricity was permitted according to Jewish law. No turning on and off lights, no cooking, no driving, no television, no radio, no telephone. Other Shabbat laws meant no writing, no use of money, no baths, no bicycles, no drawing, no carrying anything outside. By the time my father left, I had already had my Shabbat bath, which meant I got to use my mother's special green soap that came in a tall green plastic bottle and that had to be held upside down and squeezed in order to release its dark liquid, so green it seemed black. The soap smelled like pine, which in turn smelled like my mother. Because I was almost six, she sometimes let me squeeze the bottle myself, but I usually squeezed out too much, and it was from Jerusalem, which I knew to be the holiest place in the world and very far away. It was also the place where my parents had met and where I had been born, though we had left when I was a baby, and I knew it only from stories. My mother squeezed out the soap for me onto a rough brown tool she called a loofah, which I thought was the Hebrew word for sponge. Then she'd say, "Stand up, Sarah, honey." And as I stood knee-deep in the bathwater, she would scrub my legs and arms, especially my knees and elbows, my shoulders and my back, until my whole body was slick with a thin green gloss. She told me this was very good for my skin, even if it stung a little. "Now you'll glow like the Shabbat queen," she said. I slinked back into the water to rinse off, and also to swim like a dolphin, which I sometimes thought I was. It would have been easier to imagine if our bathtub was white, like at my cousin's house, which lent the water a blue cast, as though it were an inlet in an ocean. Instead, our tub, along with all the bathroom tiles, was avocado green, making the bath water a murky and forbidding hue. Still, I would have stayed in the bath forever, if not for my mother telling me that if I didn't get out in time, I wouldn't be able to kiss Abba goodbye before he left. Sometimes I'd say to my mother, "Ima, wrap my hair up like you do after your bath." But she would tell me my hair was too short and didn't need to get wrapped up. So sometimes, secretly, when she thought I was getting dressed in my room, I would stand in front of the mirror and try to wrap my hair up. But I could never get the towel to stay. And then my mother would be calling me, telling me to hurry, that Abba would soon be leaving. I had special dresses only for Shabbat. In the winter, I usually wore the one with small, dark-colored roses and a big lace collar. I had another one with black, dark green, and burgundy stripes and a matching sash, which was my favorite word. I also had a white satin blouse with pearl buttons and a high neck collar that went underneath a navy wool jumper with big silver buttons and a knife pleated skirt, sent to me by my grandmother from New York in a big Bloomingdale's box. In the summer, if we weren't having guests, I was allowed to wear my white camisole, which was my second favorite word, with pajama bottoms. I put on a Shabbat dress and I brushed back all my hair, which made me feel very clean. And I felt so proud to be clean for Shabbat and to smell like my mother, who in turn smelled like Jerusalem, I was sure. I ran to the door and my father picked me up and gave me a kiss and said, "I'll be back soon." While my father was gone, my mother and I set the table with many extra places for the guests and even extra for the people my father might invite that night. We did not use the everyday dishes. We used the once-a-week Shabbat dishes with their heavy cream centers and golden vine edges. The silverware for Shabbat was also heavy, and I would have liked to set the table slowly, stopping just to feel the weight of it in my hands. But the sun was setting, and the chicken soup was simmering on the stove, and the challah was warming in the oven, and my mother was putting the lights on timers and asking me to put away my markers on the floor as my baby sister played with a rattle on the rug. Everything was speeding forward, but poised to stop suddenly at the set time. Every piece of furniture, every bowl and plate, every lamp and pillow was racing toward the same goal, which kept coming closer and closer until we lit the candles and everything came to a halt. My mother had two candles in her tall silver candlesticks. In front of hers were my two candles, set in my small candlesticks. My mother wrapped her hair in a blue silk scarf, differently from the way she wrapped her hair after a bath. And this time, I got to wrap my hair in a scarf too, which my mother tied at the back of my neck. My mother lit her candles, then she lit mine. She used one match for all four candles and never seemed to get scared when the flame ate up the match and crept close to her fingers. We held our hands up in front of our faces and then moved them from the candles to our eyes in three flowing motions. My mother explained to me that this was how we welcomed the Sabbath Queen. We said the blessing over the candles. Then my mother put her hands very tightly over her eyes and swayed back and forth, and her lips moved, but no sound came out. I tried to imagine what she might be saying, but I understood it was not something I could ask about. My mother was very serious then, and if I had tugged on her sleeve, or even if my baby sister had started crying from her crib where she was sleeping, she would have ignored us. I guessed she was talking to God, and I swayed back and forth and made my lips move with no sound coming out, so I could talk to God too. Sometimes my mother would cry, and to be like her, I cried too. Then she would hold my face in her hands and kiss both my cheeks and say, "Good Shabbos." She would take the scarf off my head, and if she had been crying, she used the ends of her scarf to dry her eyes, the blue silk darkening in spots like deep water. While we waited, we read books, or I told her about what I was learning at school. When my father came home with the guests, we all sat down at the table, and Shabbat really began. My parents never made a separate kids' table like they did at my cousin's house, because they knew I liked to sit with the adults and help my mother and answer my father's questions and listen to everyone talk after the other kids had gone downstairs to play. My mother brought the two challahs out from the oven, gleaming with heat and egg yolk glaze. She placed them at the center of the table, beneath the white challah cover embroidered with Hebrew words I couldn't read. I had learned in Sunday school that the two challahs symbolize God and the Jewish people, and that we keep them covered so that they don't feel embarrassed that the wine is blessed first. As my father held the wine goblet in his hand, my mother gleamed like the warm, shiny face of her challah, except even more beautiful. The wine overflowed, dripping down my father's fingers and onto the saucer beneath, a symbol, I knew, of God's kindness. My father began to recite the blessing over the wine. There was night and there was morning, the sixth day. His voice grew louder as he reached the part that thanked God for giving us the Sabbath as a remembrance of creation. My father had explained to me the creation of the universe, that God created the sun and moon and stars and all the planets and every living thing. If God created us, I wanted to know, then who created God? My father explained that God had no creator. He was the Ein Sof, the source, with no beginning and no end, a power so big we could barely find words to describe it. My father put his hands on my head and blessed me. He asked God to make me like Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah, to watch over and protect me, to shine his face upon me. As I stood beneath his hands, I imagined the guests looking at me, thinking I was the luckiest person in the world. At first, I was excited we were moving. Since I could remember, we'd been living in a series of small towns near the Iowa border, where all the kids were Catholic. Now, we were going to live near my cousins, in one of the fancy suburbs on Chicago's North Shore, where there were more Jewish kids my age, and where I would go to Jewish school every day of the week, not just on Sundays. We were moving because my father got a job as the rabbi of a new synagogue, but also because my mother wanted to be near her family. We'd be living 20 minutes away from where she grew up, where her brother and extended relatives still lived. At my new school, my mother told me, I would go to prayer services every morning. There was a little chapel, my mother explained, where all the children prayed together and read Torah on Monday and Thursday mornings from a miniature Torah scroll that had been saved from the Holocaust. I had only the dimmest sense of what she meant by that word, but I knew it had something to do with suffering beyond my comprehension and the Never Again sticker on the leather-bound notebook in which my father took notes for his sermons. I would have two teachers at this school, my mother explained, instead of just one. Mrs. Paley would be my teacher for math and reading, and in the afternoon, Gveret Ashkenazi would teach us Hebrew and Torah. I marveled at a name as foreign-sounding as Gveret Ashkenazi. Stepping into her classroom, I imagined myself entering an alternate reality. A reality I knew about from the picture books my mother read to me before I went to sleep. Books where women walked around in kerchiefs carrying eggs in baskets, and men wore caps and beards as they pushed wheelbarrows down a dusty road or scurried off to the afternoon prayers. But most of all, I was relieved that I would no longer have to explain to the other kids why I couldn't go to their birthday parties on Saturday afternoons, why I couldn't eat the pepperoni pizza, even if the party was on a Sunday, and what my father did for a living. It seemed all the kids at school had fathers who were firemen or policemen or something else that was easy to explain. When people asked me what my father was, I'd say, a rabbi, having learned to add, it means he's like a priest, but Jewish. Most kids seemed satisfied with this answer, but one day, John Mark Hansen, who was always trying to chase me during recess, said, if your dad's a priest, how come he has a family? Don't you know priests aren't supposed to have kids? I wanted to explain to him that the rules weren't the same for rabbis, that without a family, my father's public role would be empty. Without my mother, I wanted to tell John Mark, who would light the candles? Who would braid the challah? Who would tell me stories from the Torah? And I knew, without ever having been told, that without me, or my baby sister, or the baby that was just now growing in my mother's belly, my father's life would be lonely and monotonous, his devotion without purpose. But I didn't know how to put into words any of what I wanted to say to John Mark, so I told him I would have to ask my father, who I was sure would know the answer. I would be starting second grade in the fall, and my mother told me that in preparation, I should sit down with a piece of paper and practice writing the alphabet. But I already knew I could do that, so instead, I decided to make a list of every word I knew. As I wrote, I began to realize that so many words had variations. Did tree count as a separate word from trees? Was walking worthy of its own entry, distinct from walk? I decided the answer to these questions was yes, and the list kept growing, until my pink marker ran out and I had to proceed in blue. Even as I wrote, I kept getting distracted, remembering forgotten words. I realized then that there weren't enough hours in the day to record every single word I knew, and that even if there were, by then, I would have learned so many new words that I'd have to start from scratch. I realized then that if you try to record everything you know, everything you think about, and everything that happens to you, and you try to use words to hold it all, you will fail. Because the task will become bigger than you. The recording itself will eclipse that which was meant to be recorded, and you will ultimately vanish inside it. It will take years to convince myself that words are not the enemy, that telling this story will not eclipse me. It will take a lifetime to understand that I can record everything I know, everything I think about, and everything that happened to me, and I will not vanish. Chapter 2, The Still and Quiet Afternoon. We are eating lunch together on a Saturday afternoon. It is almost summer. My dad is at one end of the table, my mom at the other. The rest of us, including my best friend Eden, who slept over the night before, packed into folding chairs on either side. My father has returned from synagogue, which means he's taken off his jacket and tie, combed his hair back, and changed into a t-shirt bearing the emblem of the youth group chapter he used to lead. My mother has laid out a feast, each dish glimmering against the dark blue tablecloth like a star in the night sky. It is, of course, the Sabbath. We have already blessed the wine, washed our hands twice on each side, and remained silent until we ate the bread. We've already recounted how God created the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh, already proclaimed the Sabbath, a sign forever between the Jewish people and God, when my parents begin to tell the story of how they met. I have heard this story before, but I never tire of hearing it again. The first time my mother met my father, he offered her almonds. She was coming out from between the barracks, nestled among the pine trees, and he was coming at her with his blue eyes and big smile and well-fitted khakis. "Your mother thought I looked like Paul McCartney," my father says. "You wish," she says and starts laughing. This was in the winter of 1970. On a kibbutz near the Syrian border, where they were both working as volunteers. My mother had been raised in great suburban comfort, with the understanding that one day she would marry a young lawyer or doctor or an heir to a furniture chain. There were any number of eligible young men at the country club she could have chosen from and made her father happy. Instead, she'd gone traveling around the world and found my father, a college dropout from Miami in search of God. At the kibbutz, my mother was assigned to pick grapefruits, my father to run the guest house. They were both on their way to somewhere else, in between being the people they had been and the people they thought they could become. "The thing about him," my mother says, and here she directs her attention to Eden and me, "is that he was a great dancer. And he had tons of tapes, Neil Young, Pink Floyd, the band. They would go to work early in the mornings before the sun came up and it became too hot. After work, they'd go hiking in the mountains. Your father could go down a mountain like a goat," she says. "I had to teach your mother a lot," he says, and she starts laughing again. She liked that he was sure-footed, that he could drive a tractor, that he had already mastered Hebrew, having previously taught himself Spanish when he was living in Mexico. At night, they hung out with the other volunteers from England and Australia and Denmark. Everyone had guitars, and they'd play Woodstock albums. Other nights, They'd watch the Katyusha rockets from Lebanon rain down like fireworks. One time, a rocket hit the chicken coop, and the next morning, all the chickens were dead. My mother wanted to go to India. Some of the volunteers had plans to go soon, others had already been. She wanted to go, and she wanted my father to come too. My father did not want to go to India. He wanted to go to Jerusalem. He wanted to study Torah. He wanted, he told my mother, to become a rabbi someday. But first, he would have to study. Like my mother, he came from an assimilated Jewish family. If he wanted to inspire people, he told my mother, to bring them back to God, he needed knowledge. He told my mother she didn't have to look for spirituality in some faraway place. She could look for it in Jerusalem, with him. One Friday afternoon, they took the bus to Jerusalem, arriving before sundown. At night, they walked to the old city, to a candlelit apartment, where a smiling rabbi was leading people in song. He was talking about joy. The joy of serving the Creator. The joy of knowing where you come from. Men and women, separated by a makeshift curtain, closed their eyes and sang along. If they didn't know the words, they hummed or clapped. Some held babies on their hips or in their laps. My mother had never seen fathers so at ease caring for their children. There was a feeling of contentment in the room, or maybe it was something else, something my mother could not put into words. I want to hear more of the story, especially the part where my mom leaves for India, then sends my dad a telegram from Istanbul telling him she's made a mistake, that she's making the return trip by boat, that he should meet her at the Haifa port. But I can't, because the story's interrupted by my little brother's fighting. Joseph's punching me, Ephraim says. No, I'm not, Joseph says. You are too. No, I'm not. Boys, stop it, my father says. Mom, he's still punching me, Ephraim says. I look over at Joseph, who is doing his guilty half grin. Why don't we play a game, I say. Eden rolls her eyes. Oh, Lord, you guys with your games. It was true. With the exception of my mother, we all loved games. Monopoly, chess, cards, Chinese checkers, it didn't matter. The games were a necessity. The Sabbath constituted 25 hours in which we couldn't watch TV or get in the car or talk on the phone. We had always lived apart from the religious community. We did not know anyone else who lived like us. My parents had chosen to live among the assimilated because we were there to set an example. I suggested we play the category game, which involved picking a category, state capitals, American presidents, tropical fruits, anything really, and going around the table, each person offering an entry, until only one winner remained. It probably wouldn't surprise anyone that the winner was always my father, since he knew everything. I don't want to play a game, my sister says. That's only because you always lose, I say. We're playing, my father declares. The category is Beatles songs. Everyone except my little brothers takes a turn, getting the easy ones out of the way first. Help, I want to hold your hand. Can't buy me love. Even my sister and Eden know those. We cover the basics. Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, Yellow Submarine, Taxman, Eleanor Rigby. My brothers have now left the table to play with their action figures. Back in the USSR, my mother says. While my guitar gently weeps, my father says. Dear Prudence, I say. We've just about covered the White Album, my father says. What's the White Album? My sister asks. What's the White Album? My father says, what's the White Album? And for a moment, I wonder if he really is mad. He turns to my mother and asks, how can a child of mine ask such a question? My mother shrugs. It's only the best album the Beatles ever made. Some people
Sample complete. Ready to continue?